Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, July 25th, 2013. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, we continue our tour of Philadelphia area breweries with a stop in Ambler, Pennsylvania, at Forest and Main Brewery. Owners and brewers Jared Olson and Daniel Endicott talk about turning a 19th century house into a neighborhood pub. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. You can find me on Twitter at Basic Brewing, all one word. On Facebook, I am at facebook.com/basicbrewing.james. Our show page on Facebook is at facebook.com/basicbrewing. We are on Google Plus, too. Thanks to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. You know how that works. Whenever you think of shopping on Amazon, go to basicbrewing.com first. Click on the Amazon link. That will take you to Amazon, and then you can shop how you usually do. It won't cost you any extra, but you'll be helping to support this show when you do shop that way. We greatly appreciate your support. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own Magazine and the American Home Brewers Association on the site, too. Our Basic Brewing iPhone app is on iTunes, and our Android app is on Amazon.com. We're on the BlackBerry Podcast Directory, and we're on the Stitcher app as well. And we're on the Windows Phone Directory, too. Check out our Brewer's Logbook at basicbrewingshop.com. In the front is a calendar you can use to track your fermentations and plan your brews. And the good thing about the calendar is that it is blank. So you have a full year of calendar pages no matter when you start your brewing year. And there's room in the back to log the details of up to 50 batches of beer. If you want to put a tip in our tip jar, some coinage in our guitar case, you can go to basicbrewing.com/support. Thanks to everybody who's done so already. Protect your precious beer with one of our growler bags. The bag is essentially a cylindrical cooler that is just the right size to accommodate a 64-ounce growler or a couple of 22-ounce bombers or three 12-ounce bottles. We got some good feedback this week following Bob Stemsky's no-chill aging experiment from last week's show. Let's dive into the mailbag right away to check that out. Steve from Parts Unknown writes, I just listened to your new no-chill podcast, and do people do no-chill batches just in a standard 6.5 or 5 gallon glass carboy? Once it's down to pitching temp, pop the airlock off and pitch the yeast. Do you really need one of those plastic cube containers? Let me be clear about this. Do not under any circumstances put boiling or near boiling water or wort into a glass carboy unless you want to wind up in the hospital and or our end of the year brewing disaster show. The glass carboy will surely shatter. Letting the hot wort cool in the plastic container will warp the container, but it will not shatter into shards as it would if you would put a hot liquid into the glass carboy. Some of the ones that I have actually say on the bottom, do not put boiling water in here, something like that. So no, do not put hot wort into a glass carboy. Chuck Brockman wrote on my Facebook page, Chuck says, I was listening to the latest radio broadcast with Bob Stemsky, and I have one concern about the no-chill brewing process. I think pouring any hot liquid into a plastic container could cause the leaching of unwanted substances into one's wort. Well, I commented under that, and I put Bob's name in there, and he replied first by quoting the website where he got his plastic container. The quote says, these are high-density polyethylene HDPE-UN packaging type 1H1 compliant, FDA compliant, ideal for use with sanitary chemicals, flavorings, concentrates, edible oils, pharmaceutical preps, ag chem chemicals, miscellaneous food, and kindred products. Sounds like it's been tested with a bunch of stuff. But Bob says the use of these are not certified for storing hot wort. Nothing that we know of is. So, yes, there is always a worry. We've been going over this in Australia and here for years now, and some people do worry about it, Bob says. Bob says, I don't, but if you worry, don't try it. Peace of mind is worth everything. They do sell wort in containers like these in Australia, and they have a 2-year shelf life. So thanks for replying to that, Bob. Speaking of selling wort in containers like that, Bob from Vancouver, writes, the storing of a no-chill cube for several months for later use is basically the same process with the high-gravity wort kits available here in Western Canada and many other areas of the Canada and the U.S. Bob says, for those unfamiliar with the high-gravity wort kits, the more popular ones are from R.J. Sagnol's craft winemaking as the Brewhouse. These kits consist of a 15-liter bag in a box of high-gravity wort at about 1070 to 1080 specific gravity. While the wort is chilled during the brewing process, it is acidified to avoid spoilage and includes potassium bicarbonate to bring the pH back up for yeast growth. Interesting. Bob says, Canada Bob says, the company indicates 9 months is the ideal shelf life limit. The kits are very popular with many of the homebrew clubs in Western Canada. Contrary to the disdain mentioned in last year's BBR episode, many homebrew club members have made medal-winning beers by hacking the Brewhouse kits with different yeasts, water concentrations, and partial steeps of additional grains. One of the big advantages of these high-gravity wort kits is when there is a need to brew but no time to brew, or, as Bob says, from my 8 years living in Alberta, Canada, it was too cold to brew outside at 25 degrees Celsius below zero. Our buddy Darnell Bronner writes, if any of your listeners are phobic of hot liquids sitting in plastic, I've done no chill in a corny keg. Darnell says the key is to pressurize with CO2 so that when the wort cools, it doesn't implode your corny. With a slightly shortened dip tube, insert joke here, you can transfer the wort. With a slightly shortened dip tube, you can transfer the wort using CO2 to a carboy. I oxygenate using bottled O2 to push out any dissolved CO2. Also, it could be that the extra IBUs you might get from the wort staying at near boiling temps longer balances out the potential AA or alpha acid precipitation. Oh, that's an interesting thought. Finally, Neil from Kibbutz Keturah in Israel writes, I'm listening to the latest podcast covering a very exciting no-chill experiment. Here in Israel, we've been no-chilling for about 8 months and have been enjoying the time-saving, water-saving aspects of this technique while brewing many styles, IPA, pale ale, double, wheat, blonde, and stouts. We've never tried a controlled experiment, but all our beers come out tasty, clean, and satisfying. The time-saving benefit is huge. Neil says, I had considered stockpiling wort, and now that you've discussed your recipe, I'm considering buying a few more containers and incorporating and expanding the technique. Please let us know if you do that, Neil. Neil says, by the way, I've successfully used a no-chill 25 liters as a partial boil combined with 25 liters of boiled water, combining them together to make a 50-liter batch. Interesting. I used this once on a Belgian brown style and once with a pale ale, similar to New Albion. With the pale ale, we make sure to add the last hop addition directly to the no-chill container. Cool. Lots of excellent information from brewers all over the world. This internet thing just might work out. it's interesting to see what conversation a new brewing technique generates. Now let's move on to our interview. Whenever we go to the National Homebrewers Conference, it's tempting just to stay in the conference center because there are amazing beers there and amazing brewers. But, you know, if you do that, you'd miss out on the local beer scene. Well, this year, we were very lucky to have Brian Colasar from thebrewlounge.com to take us around and show us around his native Philadelphia. Well, this week, we stop in Ambler, Pennsylvania at Forest and Main. Here we are at the Forest and Main Brewery in Ambler, Pennsylvania. So far, I've got that right. And here we have a Jared Olson.
How's it going?
And Daniel Endicott.
Hi, guys.
This is an interesting, and we have Steve Wilkes across the table.
I'm always across the table.
And Andy Sparks.
It's always great to be here.
And Brian Kolesar.
Still here.
Brian's driving us around. This is our third stop on the whirlwind tour of the Philadelphia area. And man, we just came from Victory. And if there's one of the things I love about the brewing industry is that it takes all shapes and sizes. And here we have Victory, which is very industrial. They are at 50 barrel batches now. They're expanding to 200, and you know, very kind of industrial and delicious, but kind of a different vibe than we have here. Jared, how would you describe your establishment?
We're definitely more like the neighborhood brew pub. Ambler is an awesome town. You know, it's a walkable town. We have the train station that's, you know, maybe 30 minutes to Philadelphia. And it's just nice to be part of like this community where we can, you know, focus on the beers we love and then just kind of share them directly with the customers. You know, I love what Victory does, but it's definitely a different scale than what we're doing here. We have like a tiny 7-barrel system.
And this is not what you would, if you looked at the front of it, you may not think that there's a 7-barrel system in the back.
Not at all. It's a little, still surprises us that we fit it all in here. So,
and this is a beautiful old home. Is this Victorian style? What style is this?
Yeah, it's a Victorian style. It dates back to the 1880s. By some accounts, it's the third oldest house in Ambler, which is pretty cool. We meet people all the time that like have either known people that lived here or were born here. We had like a table come in once, and you know, they're telling us, "Oh, that was Mom and Dad's room. That was Charlie's room." And
wow,
it's pretty cool. Just like the history, you know.
And it feels homey. I mean, Steve, how would you describe the establishment?
It's just absolutely lovely in here. It's just it's an old home, and it feels like people have lived here, and there's real history to this place. I'm as fascinated by the restaurant aspect of this, of your business, as I am by the brewery. As much as I love the brewery, but the idea that you can come here and be in a home and feel like you're in a home, but also kind of in a museum a little bit. Everything is just so organic feeling to me. There's nothing industrial about this place at all. And so I just dig it. I texted my wife and I said, "You got to come here." She's like 800 miles away, but.
What about you, Andy? What are your first impressions?
Well, it's really a neat place. Yeah, you walk in, the floors kind of creak and the stairs creak, and you know, you feel like you're in an old house. You know, but in the middle of the front parlor is a huge rustic bar with delicious saisons and all sorts of really interesting beers. You know, I mean, we haven't really gotten into that yet, but you know, I think that's the real star of the show here.
You know, I asked Michael Tonsmeyer, the mad fermentationist, for suggestions of breweries that we need to visit in this area, and yours is one of the three that he recommended. And Brian knew of y'all already, I mean, how would you characterize the brewery, and how would you characterize what's going on here, Brian?
And I love Philadelphia and the Philadelphia region because it's made up of a lot of towns and neighborhoods like this. And if I lived in a neighborhood, a town like this, I could picture myself getting off my job in the city, maybe walking home from the train, maybe asking the wife and kids to walk down from the house and maybe meet me here. We'd sit out in the front porch. You'll probably have some pictures or video up later on the site, I'm sure. The hop vines growing up over the front porch and the table sitting out there. It's a place you can meet up with your buddies and play darts later. But it's not a sports pub feel. It's not an overwhelming feel. It's a comfortable feel. And, I mean, sounds like I'm recording a commercial for these guys, but I would love to live in a town that has this place right around the corner from me.
And the TVs, the big screen TVs, blend in so well with the decor.
Yeah, we debated even putting the little TVs we did, but we're Phillies fans, and you know we have to put the game on. But that's really all that shows on there.
I don't even remember TVs.
Yeah, we try to hide them pretty well.
So who wants to tell the backstory? Who wants to tell the story of how all this came into being?
I don't know, like, where the backstory really starts. I mean, like, Dan and I have actually been friends for a little longer than 10 years, I'd say. And we were both homebrewing. You know, I was working at another brewery before, and Dan was, you know, planning to start his own brewery. He was studied at brewing in England, and we were both kind of planning like our own solo projects, and then kind of decided that, you know, we were always bouncing ideas off each other and had so many like common interests and like, you know, seemed to jive so well that we thought, you know, let's team up and kind of pool our resources a little bit. And also just like the brewing interests that we had, we thought were very different but balanced each other really well. You know, Dan comes from more like the session English style beers, and like my background's more with like the farmhouse Belgian stuff. And while they seem very different, they kind of have like a similar effect on your palate and like work very similarly with food. And we just kind of thought that they would complement each other really well.
And we've been called schizophrenic for that, I think. Because we really only stick to those two styles. I mean, you won't come in here and find like a Hefeweizen on tap or a lager. I mean, as much as we love a good Pilsner, Victory makes an amazing Pilsner. It's just we kind of brew the beers that we like to brew and drink and can brew too. I mean, we can't really physically do a Pilsner, but just, you know, we find enough within those two big broad styles of beer, Belgian and British, that we don't need to, you know, stray any further. So I guess where Jared left off was, I think one day a Good Dog or a White Dog, we decided to partner up and started looking for places. We were looking at equipment then. We bought that old brewery that you saw downstairs up in New Hampshire. Took a crazy trip up there, rented a U-Haul truck, bought it back. Just managed to bring our lives back to them. So we were looking downtown for a while. We looked at a place in Fairmount, just never really worked out. And then we decided that downtown was pretty saturated, you know, not with so much with brew pubs, but just saturated with everything else, plenty of good beer. And also, I think at a certain point we realized that neither one of us wanted to really live down there. Jared was starting a family at that point. Kind of wanted to be a little more out in the suburbs, so we decided we wanted to stay along the train tracks, somewhere with a downtown feel, you know, the neighborhood, walkable, kind of like the English pub, Belgian cafe type idea. And we both grew up around Ambler, so we stumbled upon this place, actually looked at the big warehouse next door. Needed so much work that we couldn't do it. Our realtor brought us this little old Victorian house, like a fraction of the size. And we did the math, did the floor plan, and we could just barely squeeze everything in. And the rest is kind of history. You know, we did that. We spent like 16 months renovating the building. It was all carpeted. The plaster walls were pretty much shot when we moved in. It had track lighting everywhere. So, yeah, we just kind of brought it back to its old charm. With the help of Brian a little bit.
Brian wields a mean chainsaw,
yes,
I understand.
Does. Yeah. I was a little worried he was going to bring all his limbs home.
My wife was out of town that night, and I called her up on the way home saying, I took my chainsaw and I went to a future brew pub tonight. She said, wait, what happened? And what order did this all happen? And were you drinking while using that chainsaw?
We have pictures somewhere, but it was like I think it was like 18 feet long or something. It was some of the
massive split down the middle, yeah. 14 inches square and maybe like 18 foot long, and yeah, barely made it through it.
I think it took three chains to get through.
Yeah.
Tank of gas.
The fact that we opened this place and all still have our limbs and our fingers and everything, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, you can definitely tell from looking around at the design and whatnot that they put a lot of manual labor into it and a lot of TLC into making it what they want it to look like and feel like.
You've made it past the anniversary point, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had a big party in the middle of April. And it's kind of crazy, you know, I'll say the same thing about like living with my son as like owning this place. You know, I can't imagine my life without it, but you know, it feels like just yesterday that we opened at the same time. It's a kind of cool mix of emotions there.
So talk about the brew house. Who wants to talk about the brew house? It's seven barrels, but you know, a lot of people could have it in their garage.
Yeah, it's really cobbled together, you know, a real Frankenstein system, mixed like old dairy tanks and old wine fermenters. And we pretty much, you know, source most of it from one source, and then kind of added a couple pieces to it from another old brewery that was using some dairy equipment. And yeah, we really pack it in there. You know, I don't think either of us really cracks 150 pounds, so like we can maneuver through those tanks pretty well. And yeah, you know, the styles of beers that we're focusing on are, you know, either lower gravity or really fast fermenting farmhouse ales. So they kind of lend themselves to like a lack of space in a way. We can get through fermentation really quickly. Mm. And then, you know, the fact that we're serving all the beer here on draft, you know, we're burning through it pretty quick too. So, you know, it's always kind of at its peak freshness.
So do you guys, what do you think about styles? What do you think about the pigeonholes? What do you think about the typical beer descriptors?
I think we were talking earlier at the bar. I studied over in England for a little bit, and it changed really the way I approach making beer and looking at beer styles. Because, you know, you're over in England, you think they're English brewers, they're making English beers, bitters, you know, stouts, porters. But they're just making beer in their minds. You know, they're brewing whatever 4% bitter, but they're throwing tons of American hops into it and just doing whatever they think tastes good. So at that point, I just come from like BJCP, where I was all, you know, focused on styles and gravity and all that stuff, and that just didn't really matter to them. Aside from paying the taxes on the gravity and whatnot of the beer, they just made the beer that they wanted to make. You know, it might have been dark and hoppy, it might have been light and hoppy. So that's the way I approach making beer right now. You know, like the beer you guys tasted a little bit ago was like a stout with a bunch of American hops in it. I don't know that I'd really call it a dry stout. I don't know that what I would call it, but it's just a fun beer that we decided to make. So we just kind of throw styles, you know, out the door, and until it matters. I mean, we find that on the menu it helps to sell beers, you know, because people need a little guidance, you know. I know, even as a person that doesn't care about styles, if I look at a beer menu, I want to know, like, all right, that's a dark beer, that's a light beer, a sweet, you know, whatever. So they help in that respect, but after that, I think people get too hung up on it.
So how do you start? I mean, if you're not starting from, you know, a home brewer says, I'm going to brew a stout, I'm going to brew a porter, I'm going to brew whatever. And so then you have kind of a framework in your mind of what your target is. If you don't have a style, how do you start?
I think in general we look at, you know, kind of flavor profiles that we're shooting for. You know, another thing we do here, we don't really have house beers like a lot of brew pubs do. We have a couple beers that like repeat themselves pretty regularly, but for the most part, you know, our beer list is always changing, and that's just one of the awesome things about being a brew pub, where you can kind of do whatever the hell you want. So we'll kind of, you know, look at the draft list and be like, okay, what beer's going to kick? Okay, like, what's going to be left with the draft list? And then, you know, kind of like, what flavors are we missing right now? And like, you know, what time of year is it? You know, what kind of new things are on the menu that might, you know, go well with something? So, yeah, we kind of like approach it from flavor first, and then kind of look at how we're going to achieve that, either like through yeast or through hops or through like the color of the beer or the strength, you know, and then kind of just like work backwards and be like, what are we going to call this beer? You know, like the beer Dan was talking about, it's like, you know, that's not a black IPA or whatever they're calling that now. You know, it's would be too roasty for those categories, but it's not, you know, a stout, it's too hoppy for that. But what it has is, you know, a lot of like fruit flavor from the hops, and it has a lot of like chocolatey and roasted malt character from the malts, and, you know, some like apple fruity notes from the yeast, and that's what it is, you know.
So you do have a beer menu that is descriptive. I mean, yes. you do say what the beer is.
Right.
And maybe, I mean, if you're not familiar with styles, maybe that's more helpful.
And we've found that, you know, we won't so much say this is a porter or whatever. We'll try and describe the flavors to someone. You know, this is a smooth, dark beer, you know, low bitterness, et cetera, et cetera. And we find that that's more helpful because, you know, especially our clientele that we get, our demographic that we get, you know, on Friday and Saturday, it's a lot of older couples that come in and they've heard about craft beer, but they don't know, you know, they don't really know a porter from a stout. So to just say this is a dry stout doesn't really help them so much. So, you know, we've just found that being more descriptive outside of the usual beer terminology helps our demographic a lot.
So, Steve, you were nodding a lot when Jared was talking about brewing outside the style guidelines. I think you brew outside the guidelines a lot.
I do. I mean, I think we're very kindred spirits in that when I make beer, I don't really start out going, well, today I'm going to make a pill, you know, just like you guys. I think more about the flavor that I'm after, and I'm very interested in food. And so I guess the question that I would ask you would be that, you know, when you sit down with your menu and you sit down with the kitchen, your chef, whoever's doing that, do you have discussions about this is where we're headed with our food in springtime? You know, I don't know what, you know, lamb's going to come in or mussels are going to be in season or whatever it is. And then do you coordinate your brewing to kind of go with that?
Not so much that clear cut. I mean, I think it's a little more kind of like playing back and forth, almost like volleying back and forth. Like she'll put on a new dish, we'll make a new beer, she'll put on a new one. So it kind of bounces back and forth like that. Another interesting thing, she does a lot of like cooking with the beer, which is really cool. Like with the finished beer, you know, the mussels are always kind of made with one of the newer beers that's on. But she also, pretty much every time I'm brewing, like we'll give her a pot of wort to cook with, and she'll either like reduce it or like make like a salad dressing from it, or like she does all kinds of stuff. She did like a chicken brine with you know, some of the dark wort. So being able to play with like wort as a cooking ingredient is something that, you know, really only a small brew pub could really work with.
Yeah, it's almost like you're having a conversation with your kitchen rather than a formal arrangement. You're talking every day, you know, every week you're having a little conversation about the flavors and what you're going to do and the food that's fresh and the beer that's fresh, and you bring that together for a whole experience. It's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Andy and I, Andy, you and I taught a continuing education class on beer and craft beer in America, and part of that was telling people that beer is food. And a few of them, I heard afterwards, that's the first time that they ever thought about that beer was actually food and not just basically a flavorless alcohol delivery device. Which is how I describe some beers that I won't mention here today. So do the beers work?
Yeah, I mean, all the beers that I've had today were delicious and unique on their own. You know, they're very special. They do a lot of kind of the saison styles, which really appeals to me, and also works very well with food, right? Because it's a complex thing. You know, the saison is not a subtle beer. You know, it has lots of layers of flavor with it. So I can see how it would lend itself well to being served and paired with food.
I'm assuming, I've forgotten it. That is my beer, right? I'm sipping a beer in front of me, and it's the what is that that I'm sipping? It's chocolatey. That was, I think, the last one that you took from the fermenter.
It's yet to be named at this point, but it's...
Didn't mean to pin you down.
Yeah, it's just finishing up its fermentation. It's pretty much an oatmeal stout malt base at around like 7% alcohol, but fermented with our saison and Brett yeast blend. So that just kind of dries it out a little bit more, adds a little more like phenol and like fruit flavor to it. But yeah, I've been pretty happy with it so far.
When you guys buy your grains, do you buy just do you just run out and buy a pallet of two row, or do you, you know, think, I don't know, you know, I'm going to get 100 pounds of Maris Otter and 50 pounds of Pilsner? I mean, how do you do that?
I mean, most of our grain bills are pretty simple. Like it's mostly base malt with like a handful of specialty grains. We just kind of like, with both the British and like the Belgian styles, we kind of like let the yeast do the talking for the most part. We use, like, you know, the best quality, like, malts we can find. Like, we use, you know, Maris Otter for most of the British stuff and, you know, a German Pilsner malt for all the Belgians. So we're starting with a good base there, but then kind of let the yeast take over instead of using, you know, 10 different malts.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, I mean, it is cooking. I mean, you have a pantry and say, you know, if you want to make a sauce of some sort, you really have to educate yourself on what each of those components of the sauce are, and when you add it to the process, and at this particular point, you really have to brew a lot to get to the point where you are.
Right. Yeah, and it's like we get new hops in, and we'll make, you know, a little hop tea of each hop, and kind of try and get a sense of the different ones. You know, we've got a lot of new hops from New Zealand that we've never used before, so that's very exciting. And you know, you kind of lately, I feel like we've constructed some beers to get a better sense of the hops, the new hops. You know, we've done like just some real pale saisons or pale ales, and just boatload of those new New Zealand hops in there to get an idea of those hops. But otherwise, yeah, it's, you know, you just, both of us have been brewing for years, and like Jared said, we make simple beers, so we're never really afraid that we're like, oh, are we adding too much crazy malt? You know, is this malt bill just too over the top? You know, in a sense, with the malt bills that we do, we're never like really pushing the box too much. But yeah, still, you know, we have fun with other things, the hops, the yeast, and you know, especially with the saisons, we've introduced some different strains of Brett there, so now that's a new variable that, you know, we're just, each new batch of beer, we kind of see how it's developing, and it's very exciting.
Have you stumbled upon rules like this doesn't go with this, or this does go? I mean, are there things that you don't do that you did that didn't work out so well?
I feel like we used to not add a lot of dark malts to saisons, but now we're doing that.
Yeah, I still shy away from American hops and saisons. Yeah, that's something that I'd never really get into. I know a lot of people love it, but I don't know.
That battle too much with the yeast character?
Yeah, I think there's just like a certain combination of flavors. That and like Belgian IPAs just kind of, I don't think work for either of us really. It's kind of like, I've had some really good ones where it's like, wow, that would have been a really good triple and a really good IPA, but I don't know if you should have combined them.
That is a tricky style. I mean, I've talked about it on the show before, but I've had some that are really good, and I've had some that, yeah, that they're the components are fighting each other.
Seven we had recently was good. I think who was?
Oh, from Boulevard.
Yeah, or no, Upright.
No, Upright.
Upright. That's right. That's right. I'm thinking. What am I thinking? I'm thinking of from Boulevard is
their Tank Seven.
Tank Seven. That's what I'm thinking of. Yeah.
Seven from Upright was very good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's another thinking out of the box brewery, which we visited up there, and that was very.
I haven't been, but I've heard very good things, and the beer is fantastic. So.
Yeah, you guys are good along. So what, I mean, is it a challenge since you don't have, I mean, do you get people who come in who need structure? Customers who come in and need structure, who need like something that's familiar every time they come in rather than, you know, like for instance, when I go to a place and I find a dish that I like, I tend to get that same dish because I know it's going to be good, and if I get something I don't like as much, I'll feel cheated that I didn't get the good thing that I know I like. You know, so are there? Do you have
that? Why we like repeat some of the beers that we do. But for the most part, I think like the good beer world in general almost has like a case of ADHD. Like it just it's you can't focus. Like nobody has their go-to beer anymore. Like I'm guilty of it, even though like I despise it in a way, you know, like I'll go to a store and it's just like, that's great, I know I've had it, that's great, I've had it a couple times, but what haven't I had here? You know, it's like, you know, the other brewery I worked at, it, like the best-selling beer was always the newest beer, and that's kind of been the way it is here too. People just kind of want whatever like the next flavor is, which is awesome in a brew pub setting. Doing things the way we are, like, you know, we're able to brew something new all the time. I think like more like the old school model was, you know, have six house beers and have, you know, one seasonal. And when we have like all these awesome beer bars in this area, you know, that have, you know, anywhere from like 15 to like 50 rotating craft taps, you know, how could like a brew pub that's kind of stale at that point compete with that? So I think, you know, there's definitely been a push with a lot of like the newer breweries open up, like Earthbread and Tired Hands, like to just kind of like always be doing something new.
So what's the strategy from here? I mean, what's the next page on the business plan?
I think we're talking about getting some off-site storage space for more barrels to age some of our beers in. We usually try and have some sour beer on tap. We don't right now. And that's usually from the barrels down the basement. And we also bottle a lot of those beers and sell them here. So we want to expand our bottle sales, you know, make it more of a regular thing. So I think that's where we're looking, is to, you know, get some more off-site space, just to kind of free up the brewery a little bit. So right now we're kind of maxed out with this little house. You know, there's not much room to put anything more in. So do that, maybe some more keg sales, and maybe just expand the beer offerings here. You know, if we can brew more frequently, we can, you know, we have, I think it was 16 taps downstairs, but only really keep like 8 going. So in theory, we could have more beers on. So.
I picture the end of the movie, The Jerk, with Steve Martin, where they said, and we got a bigger house, and it's a bigger house, but it looked exactly like this. In order to, are you worried that if you do expand, you'll lose the character of this place?
No, I think, you know, this place would always kind of drive, you know, the connection to the customers, and just, you know, the way we kind of developed and designed this place, it was, you know, our personality is coming through more than anything. And I think no matter where we end up, like, you're going to see that as long as, like, we're doing the work. So
it's a thing, but, you know, brewers, they get bigger, and then they all of a sudden they're the business guys, and they hire people to work in the back. And
I don't think either one of us can do that, really. We're too, I don't know, it's not our, I think we got into this business to get away from doing that. And yeah, we also, like, manage the restaurant and do paperwork and all that stuff, but it's not really where our heart is. So I think we'll hire someone else to do that if it comes to it, and we'll still be in the brewery, or, you know, sanding floors, all that fun stuff. So
very good. Well, I'm impressed. We're obviously all impressed with where you are now, and we wish you the best of luck in the future.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Well, thanks again to Jared, Daniel, Brian, Steve, and Andy. By the way, Andy is the owner of the local homebrew shop here in Northwest Arkansas, where I got my start, thehomebrewery.com. As we were leaving, the guys gave us each a bottle of barrel-aged sour beer from the basement. Very tasty and very much appreciated. I only wish we had time to stay for supper, but we had other places to go. And we did enjoy those places as well. And you'll hear more about that, more from Philly, next week. In the meantime, if you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form at basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Our new Basic Brewing Growler bags are available in our shop. Protect your precious home brew and craft beer as you take it from place to place as the weather warms up. Heck, I need to change that. It's already hot. Check out our support link, where you can throw a couple of bucks into the tip jar by subscribing financially to our podcasts. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. We've got combo deals to save you a few bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time. And you can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store as well. Our logbooks are in the store, too. Keep track of up to 50 batches of beer. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Speedo Women's Beach Runner Water Shoe, pink/hot pink upper with black sole, size 9, and Sure Bonder DT20 all temperature glue sticks, 4-inch. Thanks again, everybody. And remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping. We greatly appreciate your support. Don't forget, you can also join the American Homebrewers Association and subscribe to Brew Your Own magazine through the associate links on basicbrewing.com. That's all until next time, everybody. Till then, thanks for listening. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by our buddy Kelly Dotson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. Talk to you next time, everybody. So long.